Great. Well, thank you for having me. I'm trying to decide whether to stay wedded to the lectern or move around a bit, but actually I need the computer, so I'll probably stand here for a bit. And if I move, I've got to take the recording thing with me, haven't I? So you can remind me of that. It's good to be here. I've actually spoken at the GCU before, but I guess you have quite a turnover of people on research contracts, so that was several years ago. Okay, I want to talk... My topic is what is faith, has faith to do with the environment. Just let's start off just a very, very brief overview of the issues. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this and on the science and so on, but I just think it's important to flag them up. The first really big issue is that we live in a finite world and there are finite resources. We live in a society which is, it's true to say, over-consuming. We eat more than we need, we have more than we need, we want more than we need, and the West has a sort of materialistic ideology that is you're valued by your possessions and getting becomes important. So the West over-consumes. Population has been on the increase for a very long time, and 7 billion just passed. And of course, the combination of the overconsumption in the West and the global population, which tends not to be in the countries that consume, puts enormous stresses on things like land, on energy requirements, and on things like biodiversity and habitat loss. So these are finite resources that are under a lot of stress. And of course, alongside that goes the fact that we actually, in the West, throw away a lot of things as well. And our waste, the things we get rid of, has to be dealt with somewhere. It goes to landfill or it pollutes different environments. Toxic waste and plastic contamination is particularly a big problem. There's a whole area of several hundred square miles in the North Pacific that is entirely composed of microscopic, that the entire surface is covered with microscopic pieces of degraded plastic. That and something to do, I don't know exactly how it works, but the ocean currents mean that every plastic bottle that is thrown overboard of a ship kind of collects because of current movement in that part of the North Pacific and then breaks down because of sunlight and salinity and becomes microscopic particles. What effect does that have on the animals, the fish that feed there, that eventually make their way into animal and human food chains? So waste is a big issue. And then, of course, rising land and sea temperatures, which aren't actually exactly waste. I don't know why they're under that category. We've all heard about climate change, the debate over whether global warming is really, really happening. My answer to that, as someone who is not a climate scientist, is sort of a bit along the lines of, well, do I believe the doctors that tell me that if I smoke cigarettes, I'm more likely to get lung cancer? And the answer is I do, because I think most of them have done their research pretty carefully. And the ones that are paid by the tobacco industry possibly haven't, or at least weren't in the days when it was perhaps a little bit more of a contested issue. And I take the same approach to things like global warming and the science behind it, that actually I believe the people that are experts in the field who say that this is a real problem, we need to take it seriously. And the majority of scientists who are climate scientists take that view, and it's only the minorities, and quite often the ones that are in the collaboration with oil companies and so on, that don't adopt that scientific, what is a scientific consensus. So that's where I am on that. So let's go another set of issues. And the changing climate that is happening as a result of global warming results in things like too much water and too little. So we see rising sea levels, and particularly that affects low-lying countries like Bangladesh, where quite a proportion of the country is only a metre above sea level. So if you have a very small rise, you have a lot of flooding. But the other thing about water is actually, perversely, that there are 1 million people in the world that don't have access to safe, clean drinking water. And the fact that drought has increased, particularly in places like sub-Saharan Africa, means that the fight to find water, safe water, is becoming much more acute and leads, in fact, to actual warfare, skirmishes and battles as families and people groups try to secure water sources. And actually, quite a lot of the conflict that has run on in the past 60 years in the Middle East, particularly in Israel's borders with its neighbouring Arab countries, Jordan and so on, has been over the source of water that the Jordan represents. And there's a huge conflict that goes on there over fresh water in an arid country. So as weather change, climate changes, water increases, but it's not actually solving the problem of drinking water. Drought and flooding result in crop failure, and we've seen increased evidence of extraordinary or extreme weather events like floods and droughts that seem to go sort of either end of what is the expected in various parts of the world. Okay, so why should we bother about this? What does it have to do with us? I want to consider two aspects to this question and then look at a few examples. I want to first of all think about the moral justification for being concerned about environmental issues. Why should we bother? We're going to be asking the question, is there such a thing as environmental ethics? And what problems does that question raise? And then I want to look a little bit at a theological or religious rationale to this question, why bother or why care? And have a look at what religion might have to say into the matter. And I'm going to focus eventually on Christian theology and the environment, because that's my area of specialisation. And then hopefully, if we've got time, we'll look at some examples of belief in practice in one or two parts of the world. And I realise I've not checked how long you're expecting me to speak for.
45 minutes to an hour.
Okay, fine. But with some time for questions afterwards?
Yes.
Okay, brilliant. Okay, is there such a thing as environmental ethics? Well, I was provoked to ask this question by an article I read by somebody called Arne Wesselind in a Journal of Science and Engineering. And he says, we cannot look to ethics as a source for understanding our attitudes and providing guidance for our actions with regard to the environment. To do so is to require too much of ethics. What did he mean? Well, he went on to elaborate the nature of ethics. And classical ethics is the study of morality, how human beings ought to treat each other. It's predicated on the fact that all human beings have what the ethicists call moral agency and are part of a moral community. And they operate or should in this reciprocal arrangement whereby, to put it sort of baldly, do to others as you would be done by is the governing principle. Now, the classical ethical theories were probably first articulated in a sort of comprehensive form by Aristotle, the Greek philosopher. And actually, for him, it was only men, free men, that had moral agency, and slaves and women were excluded. Now, we've moved on, thankfully, a little bit from there, and we do now say that all human beings have moral agency. But that was an interesting aside. How then does that relate to caring for the environment? Now, no classical ethical theory can, I think, satisfactorily explain why we should care for the environment. One possible answer to the question is that nature is of instrumental value to humans, so we should care for the environment because it meets our needs. It provides resources for us, it provides the sort of habitat we need to live in, and that's a good enough reason for caring about it. This problem falls down, I've noticed, and I spend a lot of my time interacting with conservation biologists who are practitioners. They're sort of investing in projects that go and sort out a particular piece of threatened habitat or a threatened species. And the problem with that first thing that we do this because nature is of instrumental value is that actually a lot of the species that conservation biologists struggle to preserve have no known benefit to them or even to anybody. A lot of them are in remote parts of rainforests that nobody actually sees until a biologist discovers this very unusual species and finds that there's only six pairs of them, so tries to protect it. So that instrumental value doesn't actually really work on the ground. It doesn't work in practice. Kant, the philosopher Kant, suggested that duties to nature are what he called indirect duties. They're duties to our own humanity, and it's an anthropocentric view of the world that sees it all as focused around us and what we need. Another argument for advocating environmental ethics is that if we behave cruelly towards nature, it might lead us to be cruel to other human beings. And that's the, if you like, a sort of causal link, that what a person does to an animal propagates a kind of a cruel mentality that will lead on to a greater degree of cruelty into other human beings, which I think you can probably see has some flaws, because I think that that's a logical progression that you cannot substantiate. There's no evidence that the way we treat animals affects the way we view people. That's not a link. The problem with the instrumental view, just to go back to that a moment, is this separation that it creates between human beings and the rest of the natural world, because we are part of the natural world. And that's got quite a big theological implication, as we will come on to see. There's another problem that you get when you define ethics, even human ethics, as being including moral agency and reciprocity. And that's the question about what about those that are not capable, even human beings, of exercising moral agency. You might think of a newborn baby or an elderly person who's lost their mental faculties and so on. Or even in our culture, we actually feel that we have moral obligations towards the dead. We feel that there's a way in which we should deal with somebody who's died, and it's disrespectful to behave in certain ways. And that's a very strong cultural phenomena, which suggests that just having moral agency is not the only issue in terms of human ethics. Now, there are a number of ethicists who are looking at this question of environmental ethics, who want to extend this moral community beyond humans who have rational agency, beyond humans who don't have that rational agency because they're mentally incapacitated or they're too young, to the wider category of living things. But then the question comes, well, how do you define that and what are your parameters? So if you extend the moral community beyond the human, you might extend it to those that have sentience. So you might say animals can feel pain too, so we extend the moral community to them. Now, of course, in some senses that is right, because I think that probably we would all abhor animal cruelty and feel that there's an ethic in the way that we treat animals, particularly higher animals, if I can use that term. And that's where the problem comes in, is where you draw the line. So what level of sentience do you take account of? Animals feel pain, but at what level of feeling pain, and how do you measure pain in, say, a fish? And is it suffering because it's in pain? Those are very big questions. Are the rights of all animals equal to the rights of all humans? Or how do you separate out? Where do you draw the line? How do you rank them? And then, of course, if you're really extending it, you might say, well, why stop at sentience? Why not extend it into the plant community? How does this relate to why or whether we should preserve wild spaces? So that's one way of extending the moral community. Albert Schweitzer, who was a scientist and missionary in the 19th century, suggested we ought to adopt the principle of reverence for life. It's a biocentric outlook adopted later by ethicist Paul Taylor, who said all living things have the common membership, if you like, of Earth's community. So they are all valued. Everything living is of value, and we should value it. And there's a problem with that as well. Question that comes up, what about viruses, polio? Is squashing a cockroach as morally repugnant as killing a human being or a chimpanzee? Or how do you engage with the fact that not all life forms are beneficial to the human race? Should we not develop immunizations against fatal diseases because that is their form of life? And I think that intuitively we have answers to those questions, but actually sort of ethically and philosophically there is a real difficulty in articulating exactly where the lines are drawn. Another approach is an ecocentric approach, which leads to a valuing not of the individual but of the whole system. So you might think of valuing an ecosystem or a habitat, but then of course it's quite hard to distinguish which the dividing line between habitats and ecosystems is very sort of fluid and lines can't be drawn. Or you could adopt James Lovelock's Gaia principle, that the biotic entity is actually the whole world, that it's a sort of self-contained and mutually beneficial entity that operates in ideally in a sort of moral way. Although I don't think Lovelock actually wanted it to be a moral category. He saw it more as a descriptive one, and it's been adopted by ethicists and philosophers and religion. But there's another problem there. If you're thinking about the whole, and you're thinking perhaps in community terms of a whole system, is that you have questions about the individual. Is it okay? And this is a real live issue. I'm a member of the RSPB. If you don't know, that's the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds. And in probably 5 years ago, there was this really big issue about whether you should humans should cull an invasive non-native duck species that was breeding, interbreeding with native wild duck and causing population dilution and so on. And there was this great kind of hoo-ha. From the sort of biotic entity point of view, yes, you should actually undertake responsible culling to make sure that you preserve the habitat for the native species, to preserve what is native to the Britain and kind of limit the impact of the non-native. From the point of view of those that advocate a much more individualistic view of individual animal rights, the idea of killing anything deliberately is more repugnant. That's an even bigger problem in somewhere like New Zealand. Do we have any New Zealanders here? No, okay. In New Zealand, being an island, a fairly small island, and a very, very unique set of ecosystems, it has had huge problems in terms of wildlife and biodiversity by animals that have been brought in by Western colonisers. And actually, I've got a friend who is a wildlife biologist in New Zealand, and she works on various projects, and she says they're all about killing, trapping and humanely disposing of animals that don't belong, because actually that's the way that you can preserve the ecosystem. Once it gets out of balance, all sorts of things start to go wrong, and you know, too much predation, and it has a negative effect on the habitat and so on. So there's a huge issue there. Now, each of those pose ethical difficulties. Veselin's got three alternatives, and then we're going to leave him to one side. He says, well, you might just give up any notion of care for the environment and do the sort of survival of the fittest, let everything else go to the wall. It's not our problem, it's the next generation's. Or we could adopt whichever of those possibilities is least uncomfortable, or some kind of a sort of mix of them that is perhaps a bit internally inconsistent, but actually we feel reasonably okay with. And the third one, and this is what I thought was really interesting, and he just throws it out in his article and then doesn't follow it up, and I want to do that now. He says we could pursue other lines of reasoning instead of ethics, and he suggests looking to spirituality in nature. And that's where I want to pick up on my area of research and ask, what has religion got to contribute into a reason for why we might care about the environment? Well, I would like to say that I think is more than Veselin even hints at in his article. And the interesting thing is that this has been corroborated by a survey that was done in the UK in, I think, 2007, where they approached 20 leading conservationists and ecologists and environmentalists and asked them to list the 50 things that will save the planet. And then and this was an environment agency survey. It had no kind of agenda. It just wanted them to list them. Well, they ranked them in order from the least important right up to the most important. And perhaps unsurprisingly, number one, the most important on the list from these 20 environmentalists was turn off a light. In other words, energy consumption is going to be the crucial thing. The second most important thing was religion. It's time the world's faith groups reminded us we have a duty to restore and maintain the ecological balance of the planet. And this was a call from secular, Western conservationists to religions to step up to the plate, as it were, to really remind the world that actually this is something that we should be taking seriously. And of course, in the West, and particularly in the sort of conservation organisations that are nearly all based in Western countries, and a lot of them have their headquarters in and around Cambridge, so I mix a lot with them, I've said, and they have predominantly a secular Western outlook. And they're often going into parts of the world which are extremely religious and trying to get people there to be motivated about biodiversity loss or habitat without having an understanding of what really motivates people. And if you ask the question, how many people in the world are religious, you'll see that this is a survey that took place, I think, about 6 or 8 years ago. Only 16% of the world would call themselves non-religious. I don't know if that's a surprise to you, the breakdown there. But actually, most of the rest of the world is religious, and religion is very closely integrated with culture. And I've given a talk like this to sort of geography students and people without any particular faith background, and you can hear often a sort of a gasp when you show that to people who are so ingrained in the sort of secular Western ideology that they assume that the lack of religious awareness in this country is just replicated around the world. But of course that's not true, and that's why I'd like to suggest that religion has something to offer. And what I want to do now is look at some of the possibilities of that. And I'm going to do it, as I said, by looking into the Christian tradition, which I guess we're all part of, or at least familiar with, otherwise we might not be here. And I want to present some of the possibilities I see in mainstream Christian theology and drawn from the biblical text that suggests that we might, the Christian church, Christians as individuals, might have something to say and might have a worldview that encourages us to think and care about the environment. And I suppose that when you think, as I do, I mean, my expertise is biblical studies in the Old Testament, and so I'm reading a lot of texts a lot of the time, and looking at how they might be interpreted in the light of contemporary environmental concerns. And the first thing, of course, you notice if you read the Bible is that it's really very heavily based around the God that is God that is depicted there. So it's a theocentric perspective, if you like, that we have, that God is, if you like, at the heart of Christian tradition and religion and the Bible, and that has implications pointing out, radiating out. But one of the things that I've noticed, and of course when we talk about ecology, we're talking about the interrelationship between living things and their habitats and the dependence of one on another. And if you know anything about gardening, you'll know that because last spring, this time of year, it was so cold after a very warm March that there were no bees around, so very little fruit got pollinated, so loads and loads of fruit trees didn't bear any fruit last summer. And that's a kind of a complex, and because of that there were birds short of food in the winter, because a lot of birds feed on decaying apples and so on. So there was this sort of complex structure going on whereby the ecology, the interconnectedness, was out of kilter, and so it had a knock-on effect. But I'd like to suggest that in biblical and Christian tradition there's a very strong sense of interconnectedness, not just between God and people, and we tend to read the biblical story as being the story of God's dealings with a particular group of people and then universalized out to all people. I would like to suggest that the Bible is actually portraying God's dealings with his world, with the whole world. And that includes an awful lot in biblical text of the relationship between human and non-human, and the impact that human actions or lack of actions have on non-human, and the interplay between the two. And if you read the Bible, particularly the Old Testament, particularly some of the Psalms and the prophets, you find that this interplay between human and non-human is happening all the time. And then as the sort of main player, if you like, you have God. I've in other places described it as a kind of a triangular relationship where you have God, if you like, as the pinnacle of the triangle, and human and non-human as the bottom two apexes. But of course, one of the hallmarks of the Christian tradition is that God has given human beings freedom and responsibility. And I would interpret the Genesis 1 text that talks about human beings being made in the image of God as three things: relationship, responsibility, and representation. So that we are in relationship with God, we have responsibility to the rest of creation, and we are God's representatives in the world. We're mirroring something of his morality in the world. But one of the things that the prophets of the Old Testament were very aware of is that actions have consequences. And there's a I can find it here. There's a wonderful place in the book of Hosea which spells this out. I haven't got it here. In the beginning of Hosea chapter 4, we read that the prophet is speaking the word of the Lord, and he says there's no faithfulness, there's no love of God in the land. They've forgotten the way of the Lord. They're not following God. And then he goes on in verse 2 to talk about society being full of bloodshed and murder and stealing and adultery, and talking about a sort of societal breakdown. And you can see that there's a clear causal link in his mind. When you forget God, society suffers. But then he goes on to say, therefore the land mourns, and the fish of the sea and the birds of the air are perishing. And so for the prophet Hosea, he sees that not only has human neglect had an impact on society, it's also had an impact on the rest of creation. That kind of actions have consequence crops up again and again and again in the biblical text. Now, it's not all negative, because in Christian tradition, we know that hope comes through Christ, and that God's kingdom on earth is what Christ came to bring. His death and resurrection are part of the restoring of all creation to what it is intended to be. But nevertheless, the part that humans have to play in that is crucial. Let me just digress slightly, although I think it is important to talk about creation in the Bible and how it is portrayed there. And I've got five things to say about that. The first is that we hear that creation reveals God's glory. Psalm 19. What exactly does that mean? I mean, we tend to sort of think that human beings kind of praise God and give him glory and so on. We use that terminology of humans. What does it mean that to say creation reveals God's glory? Well, my own view is that actually it's by the sheer being that the created world reflects something of God's glory. So that we've all probably had experiences where you look up at a night sky, or you look at the detail of a bee inside a flower, and you marvel at the intricacy or the splendour of it. And in that sense, by the very existence of those things, they are revealing something of God. They're able to communicate something to us, even though they don't use words. And then the question arises, well, what happens if, because of human action, some species goes extinct, or some flower ceases to grow, or some pristine river is polluted by factory effluent? What does that say about creation's ability to praise God and to reveal God's glory? Oops, the rest of them there. So creation praises God. I think you can see very, very clearly in the biblical text that although the rest of creation, and by that I mean the kind of everything other than human beings, has a very important role in the sustenance of human communities, in providing food and the materials for shelter and so on, creation has an intrinsic value. There are many places where the value of the created world is seen as a value in its own and of itself to God, rather than just because of what it provides to human beings. A classic place to look if you're interested is Psalm 104, which is a wonderful celebration of habitats and ecology, and the fact that you know, this bird needs that space and that animal needs that space, and then says God in his wisdom made it all. The text I read from Hosea suggests that creation suffers from human wrongdoing. I've already articulated that. And in very many parts of the prophets, again, we're told that creation cries out or longs or languishes for justice. There seems that sense in which the whole creation is looking for something. And that's echoed in the New Testament, in the writings of Paul, where he talks about all creation groaning as it looks forward for the restoration that is promised in Christ. Okay. Oh, I have got that text there. I thought I had it. Okay, that's the Hosea text in its full form. So you have no knowledge of God, no faithfulness or loyalty to God, then you have societal breakdown in verse 2, and therefore the land mourns and all who live in it languish. It's interesting that, because of course Hosea's writing 800 years before Christ, so he's not addressing a situation of the same level of environmental degradation that we are seeing today. But he's addressing a situation where he can see what humans do has impact. We don't know exactly what he has in mind. We don't know what he is looking at. Is he looking at some natural disaster? Is he looking at the impact of war? It could be either. But he's seeing that actually this is this is interconnected. This is not things in isolation. And one of the things that we do know is that what's going on in the world today is not just happening in isolation. I talked about consumption in the West. A lot of the controversial issues over shale gas extraction and the Alaskan tar sands extraction and rainforest destruction in Brazil, in the Amazon. A lot of the issues are to do with globalization, greed, power, and the politics associated with that. All perhaps modern day equivalents of what's there in verse 2 about what goes wrong in a society when it loses its moral compass. And that's what's happening. And the implications and the outworking of that is quite alarming. You'll know that the very famous words from the New Testament, that the first commandment Jesus says is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, and the second is this: you shall love your neighbour as yourself. There is no other commandment greater than these. And perhaps those two they might be sort of the moral or the ethical code that governs a lot of Christians' behaviour. Of course, what you have to remember in this context, in our contemporary context, is the question, who is my neighbour? I'd like to suggest in the global village in which we live, actually might well be that Bangladeshi farmer on the other side of the world who's going to be forced to leave his land because it floods as a result of a sequence of events that have started in the West because of the ways that we live and have had a knock-on effect that eventually mean that he is forced off his land because of flooding. It's the poor that suffer the most as a result of environmental issues. 1/6 of the world's population produces over half of the world's carbon dioxide. That's us. It's basically Western Europe, UK and North America produce over half the world's carbon dioxide. The poorest sixth of the world produce just 3% of global CO2. There's this huge, huge imbalance. And yet it's those people in Bangladesh, in sub-Saharan Africa, that feel the effect of the climate rises. You've only got to watch footage of disasters like the tsunami or Hurricane Katrina, thank you, yes. Hurricane Katrina, and that was an interesting one because, of course, it was the American poor, so maybe they weren't quite as poor as, and they aren't, but it still was telling in that society that actually it was the people without cars and the people who had not the wherewithal to get to higher ground that the ones that suffered. But if you go to areas which are far less able to get out of the way of trouble, relocate, then anything like a flood or a severe drought will affect those that are vulnerable and poor. And you know, we talk about in this country having a bad summer as far as crops are concerned, and last summer was for for a lot of farmers, and it was very difficult for farmers. But of course, those of us that don't farm, we may have paid more for potatoes in Tesco's, I don't know, but we still ate potatoes. If you're in sub-Saharan Africa and the rains don't come when you plant your seed, then you're stuffed, basically. You haven't got a hope. Unless you can afford to go and buy food from somewhere else. If you're a subsistence farmer, you're dependent on the regularity of climate, of seasons and weather and so on. And my husband and I visit Uganda quite often. We have links with some rural pastors there. And we've helped set up a scheme which trains the rural pastors to be pastors, like to do Bible stuff and pastoring stuff, and also to farm sustainably, to do sustainable agriculture. And, you know, it's really poignant when you go and you talk to the pastor and you say, well, what kind of a year are you having? And he said, well, the rains were late. They didn't come. We planted seeds and they didn't come. And now we're having to ask the richer members of the congregation to donate food so we can give it out to those whose crops have failed. It really, you know, puts it on the edge that actually this really matters. One of the impacts of being at subsistence level is that you're forced into decisions that might not be better in the long run in order for short-term survival. And so an example would be overgrazing of land or using scarce water to try and get those few seeds to grow, even if it means that down the road you will be struggling to find fresh drinking water for your family. And that kind of cycle of unsustainability is part of the sort of trap that people get into that means that they suffer the most as a result of largely what the West has generated. And I think that is quite an important issue for us to bear in mind. I want to take just 5 minutes now of your time, and then I'm going to throw it open to questions, because I've rushed through a lot of ground and you may want to ask things either specific or off topic, that's fine. I want to talk about a project or an organisation that I've been involved in that is an international Christian conservation organisation. It's engaged in scientific research in conservation biology and in habitat monitoring. It's also engaged in environmental education and community-based conservation projects. And it works with local communities in 20 countries across 5 continents. And what is unique, in a way, about Arusha is that it's very deliberately tried to think about human populations and what they need to survive, and also biodiversity and ecosystems and scarce habitats, and worked out ways to try and bridge some of the inevitable conflicts that happen between people and their environments when they're under pressure. Let me give you one or two examples. Arusha in India has a project in South India, and this is I think this is fascinating. In South India, there's forest, which is a national park, which is populated by elephants. Around the national park, the villagers grow their crops. But, of course, what happens is the elephants can't be confined to the national park because they can't build fences big enough to hold them in. So they crash out of the jungle every now and then and trample the villagers' crops. And therefore the villagers, understandably, want to kill the elephants. And so you have a rare species of elephant being killed because it's trashing the villagers' crops and threatening their livelihood. Arusha did some research and they found out that there are two things elephants don't like the smell of. One of them is chili and the other is tobacco. And so they had developed this ingenious plan whereby if you take thick rope and you impregnate it with chili oil and tobacco essence and you just string a single thickness of rope round the field, it keeps the elephants out. Mm. Yeah, magic, isn't it? And it's that kind of thing that actually, I would say, is a fruit of Christian wisdom, that exploring possibilities, saying, how can we deal with this, without saying, and a lot of people in environmental ethics either are very sort of pro-human and say, well, it's only feeding humans that matter, and we only need to really concern, that's our really main concern, or they become very sort of anti-people. People are the problem, we need to keep them out of the way, and if some of them die as a result of that, that's just too bad, there are too many of us anyway. And that sort of bifurcated view is I think unnecessary, and I think Arosha is showing how it can be overcome. This is another example. This is in Kenya on the east coast on the Indian Ocean, and there is the Arubo Sokoke forest, which is one of the last dry tropical forest stretches along the east coast of Africa, and it used to run all the way down pretty much, and it's nearly all gone. And of course there the problem was also that the villages around the outside of the forest were facing the problem that although primary education is free in Kenya, secondary education you have to pay for. And so rightly, they were aspiring for their children to be educated to secondary level. And the way to do that is to go into the forest, cut down the hardwood, and sell it off. And then you have the secondary school fees for your kids. But of course, that damages the hardwood that has taken perhaps centuries to grow to the size it is. So Arosha in Kenya set up what they called the asset scheme, the Arubo Sokoke School Education and Training Scheme. And what they did was, because a lot of Western tourists come to that area to go into the forest to look for the endemic species that are there, the golden-rumped elephant shrew is one of them, which is the size of a small dog with a golden rump. And a long snout, very elegant animal. They got an arrangement with the local hotels that they charged the Westerners $5 a piece as a sort of eco tax, if you like, and they set up bursary schemes for the villagers to apply to have secondary school fees paid. And so now the villagers have gone from cutting down the trees to pay for school fees to realising they need to keep the trees because it brings the Westerners in to look at the forest, and the forest is protected because they can see that it has a value not just in its own right but for them as well. And that's one of those creative interplays between human need and the need of the wider ecosystem that I find really exciting. I'm good. That's, if you're interested in Arosha, that is the Arosha website, www.arosha.org. And just to say, they do have lots of opportunities for volunteers to go and work on their projects if you've got a significant tranche of time post-PhD coming up and don't know what to do with it. I just want to end the sort of talk bit by a verse from the Bible that really is, I think, encapsulates the kind of, if you wanted to say, what's the environmental ethic of Christian faith, or the ethic of Christian faith that can be extended into caring for the wider creation. And it's this verse from Micah chapter 6. What does the Lord require of you but to do justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God? And I for me, that's a sort of a bit of a mantra. It's one of my sort of verses, if you like. I'm going to take questions in just a moment, but let me just flag up the next Faraday course on science and religion happening in July, and there are still places on it if you're interested, and I think you'd probably find, look on the website for the programme, and yeah. Okay, I'm happy to throw it open to you. As I say, I've sort of wandered far and wide, but very happy to take questions.
Well, I have two questions, but I can leave one of them to later on.
Well, if nobody says anything, you can have two.
So the first one is, I was wondering, so do you think is our responsibility limited to avoiding damaging the creation? So with all of the examples I think that you've given, it's trying to find a way for us to sit alongside Bruce and not make things worse. But would there also be a case we made perhaps for us bringing out some sort of potentiality and encouraging making it more fruitful than it would have been in our absence? And I guess I'm thinking about it in three senses. One is theologically, why would Bruce be doing that? Second is, are there case studies where that has occurred? And thirdly, given the fact that, depending on what your theological view on this would be, if there was a long period without human beings around and creation was getting along quite fine without us, what role do we now have to play in the last and bit of time that we've existed?
I think that's a really great question, actually. And my answer to all three would be yes, in all three senses. I see the kingdom of God, if you use that New Testament language, as being present and yet not fully ushered in, and the sense of Christ coming and incarnation and death sort of begun something, and we're part of that beginning. And therefore, in this present world, I see that we have part of our bringing in of the kingdom, if you like, is to act as God's representatives. And that may well mean helping creation to fulfill its potential, especially where that's been damaged because of our actions. So yes, very much theologically, I can see how, and part of, one of the myths, I think, that has crept into the Christian tradition, and I'm looking at Graham over there because I know he writes on this, is that the world to come, the new heavens and the new earth, will be totally discontinuous with this one, that it'll be a kind of a complete wiping away of this earth and a making of something new. And I don't think that can be substantiated biblically or theologically. I see that what God's in the business of doing, as he is with all societies and with humans individually, is remaking and renewing what already exists. So whatever we think of what we'll be like in the age to come, we will not be totally different people. So I think that's theologically justifiable. So without going any further into that theologically, and then I skipped over this one, but it kind of answers your question. A third Arosha project that I sometimes talk about is in Southall in Middlesex, which is right under the flight path of Heathrow, and it's very high dense population urban area, largely people from the Indian subcontinent, mostly Sikhs and Muslims, and it's pretty full-on kind of a place. It's quite noisy, dirty, cosmopolitan, a lot of traffic, a lot of social issues and so on. And there was a patch of wasteland right in the middle of it that was kind of owned by the council and the water board or somebody else, and it had been a dumping ground for tyres and cars and waste and so on. And a group of people that set up Arosha in the UK in Southall had a vision for transforming it, and it was kind of a practical thing to offer something to the local community that was a recreation space where they could enjoy the natural world and bring their kids, and do primary schools could come and do educational stuff, pond dipping and all that. But also it was a sort of sense of a prophetic call. Isaiah 35 says, let the desert blossom, let the wilderness rejoice. And it was that sense that actually, by taking a really derelict place in the middle of kind of deprived urban heartland and actually creating something beautiful where nature could flourish, was and that's it now, actually, that's what it looks like, was actually doing something that was practically, as you say, sort of making something new, if you like. And I can't remember what the third one was. It's about...
I think the third thing was if there's a long period in the world
without us, yeah. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because actually, if environmental problems got so bad that it threatens the stability of the entire earth, so if, oceans raised by 2 meters or whatever, it's the the beings at the top of the food chain, if you like, that would suffer the most. So it would have the impact on humans, but you would find that the microorganisms would sort of carry along probably quite happily, and quite a lot of other organisms. But yeah, so I think that's interesting.
A slightly related question, which is, I suppose, about species extinction.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, if we say that the Earth has always been changing and species have going extinct,
mm-hmm.
And I suppose a lot of conservation work is about stopping species from going extinct, but is that in a way a natural thing?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, how much change is too much change mm-hmm. in the environment, and how do we, what's our role in trying to mm-hmm. understand that?
Yeah, good question. And of course you're right that the whole sort of the way the world is predicated on species coming and going, and extinction. We wouldn't be here if the dinosaurs hadn't gone extinct, for example. You know, that the evolutionary history of the world is based on species coming into being and then going again. The difference, I think, is the rate of extinction. And scientists estimate that the current rate of species extinction is between 100 and 1,000 times greater than the natural evidence of previous records. So that has to say something about our responsibility, I think, and our impact. I don't think we can stop every species going extinct, but I think we have to really think carefully about how and when we allow it to happen, and what our values are. I mean, theologically, you could say if creation exists to praise God, then what does it do if we, by our actions, stop some part of creation being able to praise God? So that's the sort of theological question that I think it poses.
Throw a question out there. You mentioned briefly on a couple occasions overpopulation and the possibility that we're overpopulating anyway, so we need to almost cull back humans. And I wondered if you could speak a little bit more on that, if from sort of your interactions, both in sort of more the practical world of conservation, if you think that there is a case for trying to slow the population growth rate globally. Or if you think this is something that we could really deal just fine with if we had a better sense of consuming resources and something that was perhaps a bit more balanced, and maybe also sort of theologically, would there be a basis for trying to sort of control the growth of the human population?
These are great questions. I think that the issue of population is a very sensitive one, for the reason that, largely speaking, it's not people in the West that have large families, and a lot of the reason that people in other parts of the world have large families is for security, to provide economic resources to people to farm the land and so on. When I say the reason, I don't mean that that's a deliberate reason, but that is part of the sort of makeup of other parts of the world. And it becomes very difficult if we in the West are trying to blame other parts of the world for the population, for the environmental crisis on the grounds of population. So that's why when I talked about population, I had it very definitely second to overconsumption, because it's still the case that we, with our 2.4 kid average family size, will still produce more carbon emissions by having a family of that size than somebody in sub-Saharan Africa having a family of 10 children or whatever. So even though we may have smaller family sizes in the West, we produce more carbon dioxide. So we have to tread very carefully, and we have to tread very carefully about telling other people what they should and shouldn't do. We need to bear in mind that in countries which have enforced birth restrictions, like in Iran and in China, it leads to a lot of infanticide, because if you're only allowed one child and you have a second, what do you do? A lot of increase in abortion as well. So that's another issue. And I think we have to think, agencies that work in this area are divided. Some Western agencies would address the population issue and others were still well clear of it because it's a tricky one. My own view is that actually education and resourcing women is probably the thing that needs to happen the most, because actually 70% of the people living in direst poverty are women. And in countries where women have very little control over their sexuality and their health and perhaps not access to contraception, you know, they're in an even more vulnerable position, and where there's a lot of sexual crime against women. So I think that the issues are very complex. I would never ever say that we ought to in any way cull human population, but I also would say that it's something that people in the West should think carefully about as well. So.
So the title of the book was What Does Faith Do with the Environment? So of course you focus naturally on Christianity at all. So to what extent does faith have a contribution? To what extent can other faiths make a contribution? Or if you move outside of the Christian tradition, so what do they have similar resources that would lead them to the same conclusions?
I think you'll find that most of the major world religions have devoted time and attention to this. And so, for example, as far as Islam's concerned, there's the Islamic Foundation for Ecology and Environmental Study, which sounds like it's just about ecology, but actually if you go on it, you'll find teaching from the Quran about why you should be concerned about the environment. And there are various Jewish websites. I think that what I have found is that care about the environment actually brings people together, even though they have very different sort of doctrines, if you like, because actually most people of faith can understand a sense of this world is not ours. Either it was created by God or it's the home of the gods, or we're meant to be, you know, having a belief in reincarnation that means that you have to treat the earth as sacred. So very different religious outlooks, but I find that there's a great coming together in terms of understanding. And the Southall Project, you know, the Christians received more hostility from the sort of secular council on occasions than they did from the other community religious leaders, because you know, they could understand why you would bother. So
the motivations then potentially in some ways are similar, but in some ways they're different, so they lead to the same kind of value, but the reason they might give for that
would be different.
Are there any ways in which it leads to a different outworking? So are there particular, with the emphasis or the types of concern, environmental concerns that certain faith groups would have to go from faith to faith?
I can't answer that. I don't know. I don't have enough evidence to base an answer on. I don't know. I don't even know examples of enough other projects in other parts of the world that have come out of other faith groups, so I couldn't. Sorry.
Jill.
I would just say on that, that fatalism in religion tends to counter any project for change, social change.
Mm. Yes.
So there are definite religious values which are
contrary
to change and development.
Yeah. No, I think you're right there. And I think that fatalism is stronger in certain religious traditions than others, and that you encounter that more in some religions. Mm.
Any other final questions or final thoughts? All right.
Would you guys join in thanking me? Thanking Dr. Marley.
Could I just do a little